This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. In today's program, there is a new constitutional crisis in Egypt and a questionable election in Libya. We'll be speaking about these things with Dr. Jennifer Lowenstein, Associate Director of Middle East Studies at the University of Wisconsin. Also today, Amnesty International says that militia rule is strangling human rights inside Libya. We'll speak with Sanjeev Berry, the Advocacy Director of Middle East Studies at Amnesty International. Also today, there was a recent protest about the Obama administration and Commerce Department's negotiations on a free trade agreement that would shore up the price of AIDS drugs. Our correspondent, Thiago Barroso, was there at the protest against Pfizer here in New York City. We'll hear the story of that action. All of that and more coming up on today's edition of 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and there are double developments on the northern crown of the continent of Africa in the nations of Egypt and Libya. In Libya, that is still ruled by and large by various militia factions. There was a national presidential election. And in Egypt, there is a continuing drama between the new president of the Muslim Brotherhood, Mohamed Morsi, who is making the appearance of challenging the military shutdown of the parliament that was dissolved by the military after a questionable court ruling. And we are now very happy to have with us Dr. Jennifer Lowenstein, the Associate Director of Middle East Studies at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Welcome back, Jennifer.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, now, is this a real conflict or a drama?
I see it as a drama that could become a real conflict, especially in Egypt. And Libya, it's more difficult to say, for me to say, I should clarify, because what I've been reading has been mostly, there were a great number of fears prior to the election, that there were going to be major outbreaks of violence, that the election would not be credible, that it would be hotly contested if in fact it even went through. And yet, some of the latest reports indicate that the turnout of the election, first of all, was pretty decent, all in all, and secondly, that the election proved that fears for the Libya election proved unfounded, and that the vote passed very peacefully for the most part, that there were some minor incidents in the south and southeast, but for the most part, the vote actually passed rather peacefully, and even people, members of the Gaddafi government or supporters of the Gaddafi government came out to vote in cities like Sirte, which was his home. So I don't know how things are going to turn out, but I would say that by the appearance of it, the situation in Libya could prove to be a very positive one if there isn't some major uprising or unrest against the outcome, in which liberals, by the way, came out in front of the Islamists. In Egypt, you could be right that he at least is putting on the appearance of creating conflict, but I suspect that it will be more than I suspect he is indeed genuinely challenging some of the rulings of the Supreme Constitutional Court, that he is at loggerheads with the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, and that the steps he has taken in the last few days are going to lead to, or are very likely going to lead to, some major confrontations further on in the fall.
We're speaking about President Mohamed Morsi of Egypt, who has been somehow taken from the sarcophagus of the fundamentalism of the Muslim Brotherhood, and
right.
public relations rehabilitated, and he's being shipped out to Washington, D.C. soon to meet with President Barack Obama.
Yeah,
and
which I think is very interesting, by the way. I think it's a sign that the Obama administration is willing to countenance the idea of an Islamist party running a major Arab nation, Egypt, knowing full well that the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces holds the real power. That's what I believe the Obama administration is thinking. I don't think Morsi is thinking along the same lines. I think that Morsi and his followers, and of whom and of which there are many, he has a few different ideas in mind, put it that way. I think Morsi is very interested in challenging the armed forces' control, ultimate control over the laws and the vote in Egypt, and in that respect, I support him.
Despite occasional repressions and the jailing of many members of the Muslim Brotherhood, there has been, it seems to me, a very complex relationship between the military
yes.
and the Brotherhood. In fact, because of their prior organization, they were able to put a tsunami on the electoral process.
That's
and
exactly
beat out
right.
the real catalysts of the Tahrir Square and so on. So is there not some possibility of there being a mutual interest in the appearance of stability, which will give some cultural advance to the Brotherhood, while
yes.
the military maintains and Washington still has its interest in Egypt?
Absolutely. I would say there is no question that, first of all, the Muslim Brotherhood has dominated Egyptian politics now for at least 60 years. More than that, and some people would argue, even though it was considered an outlaw organization under the regimes of Anwar Sadat and of Hosni Mubarak. They had laws passed against them, and yet people who cloaked themselves in the name of the Freedom and Justice Party were basically Muslim Brotherhood members who just happened to choose a name that didn't indicate that. And in fact, the Muslim Brotherhood is very much part of the old Egypt. It's not a new Islamist group on the scene, not at all. It's probably one of the oldest in the Middle East. The Muslim Brotherhood was created in 1928 by its founder, Hassan al-Banna, and began not as a political movement, but as a social regenerative movement, a way al-Banna saw that many countries were looking to the West as if modernization and the liberalization of the West were the only ways to go. And he wanted to take the advanced technology of the West, apply it to Egypt, but take the values of what he saw of Islam and apply them to the country. And he believed this would bring about a true renaissance and restore Egypt's greatness.
You said something intriguing, Jennifer Lowenstein, just a short time ago, when you said that you suspect that possibly President Morsi may have something in mind different from President Obama and the long-term United States military colonialism, multi-billion dollars per year inside
right.
Egypt. And by that, do you mean that on the spectrum between cultural fundamentalism and independent nationalism that the new Muslim Brotherhood leadership in the executive branch could try and break the bond of U.S. military payments to
well,
Egypt?
See, this is we're trying to predict the future, and that's always difficult to do. Morsi is not a particularly radical figure within the Brotherhood. Hardly, by which I mean he really isn't any kind of revolutionary. He's very conservative. His views on women and other issues have not exactly been appealing to many people like me, who considers herself on the left in on many of these issues. So he may just turn out to be the very gray bureaucrat he's been drawn as. He's been painted as this person with very little originality, who is dependent on other people in the Brotherhood. That said, how dependent will he be, and will there be a kind of revival within the Brotherhood itself that will cause its members to say, wait a minute, we won the election overwhelmingly, and we don't want to now kowtow for the rest of our regime's time in power to the armed forces that basically outlawed us and tortured many of our members over the past century. So it's trying to predict what is going to happen is difficult. I think power tends to take over when people get it, and they want it. People tend to want not to be interfered with once they have power. His decision to reconvene the parliament that the Supreme Constitutional Court and SCAF dissolved just before the elections. It could be just a political stunt, but it could also be something that turns into much more than just a stunt. Partly the reason I say that is because we have to remember that the Muslim Brotherhood, I've already said, is a very old organization in Egypt, its oldest Islamist organization. That's not to say that it was at the forefront of the revolution. You know, even though it was an outlawed party or an outlawed political group or social group or whatever one wants to say it was, it is now a legitimate party with legitimate power in Egypt. And as such, they don't necessarily represent the people who went out initially to protest the Mubarak regime. The Brotherhood had cooperated with the Mubarak regime on many occasions. And so what we could see are, if this is an appearances matter, if this is a matter where the Muslim Brotherhood is just making the appearance of looking more independent than it really will be, then the United States won't have to worry. But there were hundreds of thousands of people in Egypt at these popular protests in Tahrir Square who were not members of the Muslim Brotherhood, who were not members of the Mubarak regime, who represented factions that got nothing out of this revolution. And those people are not necessarily ready to just put everything away and accept what's happened. I just don't see it as being that easy. The April 6th movement, where are their values? Where are their ideals? Where are their political decisions going to come into play? The labor unions, same thing. I mean, there were many, many people at those uprisings in which, for a good part of the time, the Muslim Brotherhood sort of sat back to watch how it was going to go. And they're the ones who are the big losers. So they may continue the fight regardless of what Morsi's intentions are right now. If his intentions are to play a good game of politics and basically obey the armed forces, well, as I said, the Americans will be quite happy with that. If his intentions are to really seize much greater power and to not allow the military to have veto power over his decisions, presidential or parliamentary decisions, then that's a whole different story. There are still millions of Egyptians who are completely left out and who put their lives on the line in many respects when these uprisings began.
Our guest is Dr. Jennifer Lowenstein, Middle East Studies Associate Director at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And Jennifer, I take your point about prediction. As Yogi Berra said, prediction is very difficult, especially about the future.
Mm-hmm.
And suffice it to say that we can stipulate
yes.
that Gamal Abdel Nasser is not walking among us today with the current circumstances in Egypt.
Yes.
But
that's for sure.
I'd like to ask you this, and you touched upon that a little bit just a moment ago, about the ghosts of Tahrir Square, the trade
yes.
unionists, the democratic activists, the people who are seeking economic and income equity and so on, with the really absurdist legal condition of the Constitution, of the Assembly, which was presumably created to write a Constitution, the
yes.
ambiguous Supreme Court ruling, and the military sealing off of the Congress and Morsi's announcement that it would be reopened and the military actually withdrawing from the gates so
yes.
that they are coming back a little bit. In the process that will follow, is there a danger, do you think, that the mutual interests of Muslim Brotherhood and military Supreme Council could inhibit or limit the reforms that would be needed for economic and social equity
Absolutely.
By the democratic forces, I mean the Tahrir forces?
Yes, and again, I think it comes down to how the power play plays itself out. As I said before, the Muslim Brotherhood functioned up to now as a kind of invisible but very visible social force in Egyptian politics. Social meaning they had deep roots into Egyptian society. They are very well organized. They have been the dominant social and, to a great extent, political force for 50-some years. But now that's changed, and that has changed in a significant way. Morsi is now the president of Egypt, Supreme Council or not. And now that they have this power, it would not be completely strange to imagine that the members of the Muslim Brotherhood, who will no doubt have some influence on Morsi, to say the least, are going to start wanting more than what the Supreme Council of Armed Forces want for them. So, yes, in a way, both parties could play off each other in a kind of symbiosis that would make all sides happy, the Brotherhood, the Armed Forces, the United States, Israel, but it certainly wouldn't make all the people of Egypt happy because there were genuine popular uprisings, and they went on for a long time. And I don't think the Egyptians are a people who are ready to just lie back down and go to sleep. So no matter what Morsi does, there are still a lot of people out there who are dissatisfied. And I am not convinced that Morsi will just be the pawn of the armed forces that the United States hopes he will be.
Jennifer Lowenstein, thank you for the insight on Egypt. Just to tag the bases on this part of the north of Africa, returning momentarily to the subject of Libya and the
sure.
election there and Mahmoud Jibril, a former member of the administration of the Jamahiriya before, after the NATO invasion and United States clandestine assistance and the sodomizing and murder of Muammar Gaddafi and the lapse of Libya into ethno-supremacist tribalism.
Yes.
I cannot
help. Horrible.
I cannot help but wonder if this election with so-called liberals had much of a black turnout given the ways that these militias have been rounding up Afro-Libyans.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that because I believe what I said was that the election may have come out perfectly fine in the sense that liberals were ahead in the polls. We don't know the final results yet, as opposed to the Islamists in Egypt, which makes it sound, I think, it makes it sound as if I'm supporting the liberals over the Islamists, which in the broader picture I may do, but I don't know that the liberals in Libya are necessarily going to be or turn out to be better than any kind of secular government anywhere. I, in general, don't support religious states. That includes Israel. And I don't really think that an Islamist state can simultaneously be democratic. And for me, that's not really good enough. I support the fact that Morsi was elected. I support the fact that in 2006, Hamas was elected, despite the fact that the United States and Israel and many other states were having nervous breakdowns. But that's not to say that a group of liberals, so-called liberals, in Libya are necessarily going to be better at running the state than an Islamist leader. I mean, the personality of the leader and the of the parliament are important in politics. In Libya, you also have the fact that it's an oil and gas-rich North African country, and it wants to appear stable enough for foreign investment. And if it can't, Libya's economic lifeline is severely damaged. So again, there are lots of different things at play, and much of it is a kind of wait and see game. I mean, I don't think most people realize that Libya was created out of, initially there were something like 11 different provinces, but those 11 were from three primary groupings, Tripolitania in the north, Benghazi in the east, that's the capital, Cyrenaica in the east, and Fezzan in the south. And it's not a homogeneous nation. You have Berbers, you have Arabs, you have Italians, and you have mixed marriages and families of and between all of these that, you know, initially it was very hard for Libya to unify into one country. And it was the sort of strong arm of Gaddafi that forced it into the state that it became. And I don't see that as a positive thing. I'm just saying that, you know, Libya was not necessarily in great shape before Gaddafi came to power, and it certainly didn't improve with his power, but it was held together the same way Yugoslavia was held together during the Cold War, by an external force and as well as an internal force that basically didn't want any dissolution. When the USSR ceased to exist, when the old sectarian rivals, ethnic rivalries resurfaced, Yugoslavia disappeared into the mist along with Czechoslovakia. They're not countries anymore. Libya isn't identical to these nations, but it also has many divisions internally among the people. There are three languages spoken in Libya: Italian, Berber, and Arabic, not in that order. It's probably more like Arabic, Berber, and Italian. But the fact is, Libya is not a homogeneous nation. It never was. So, you know, will it be in the interests of the new government to keep those three provinces unified in order, as I mentioned before, to maintain economic stability? Probably it will be. And probably most Libyans don't want to see any further conflict and bloodshed. And probably most Libyans don't also want to see Western intervention, any more Western intervention. I think they saw exactly what that meant during NATO's strikes. It's been pretty miserable in Libya for many people, and since then and before. So it's, you know, I guess what I'm driving at is, again, I hope that the Financial Times, for one newspaper, is correct in its reporting by saying that the election actually passed relatively peacefully. There was somewhere around a 60 to 62% voter turnout, that Gaddafi supporters turned out to vote, as well as people in Benghazi, where the uprising started. That could be a good sign. It could be a sign that there is a lot of relief in the country, that Gaddafi is no longer in power. I hope there is not relief that he was murdered the way he was murdered, because in my opinion, that is beneath the dignity of any nation and any people.
I thank you for your insight in this region of the world, the Middle East. We're at the University of Wisconsin. You're the Associate Director of Middle East Studies, Dr. Jennifer Lowenstein. Jennifer, how can people follow your work?
Well, actually, I do run a humanitarian aid foundation online, and the web address is www.chomskyfund, one word, as in Noam Chomsky, chomskyfund.org. It's a humanitarian aid organization that right now strives primarily to help people in Gaza and in Lebanon, Palestinians in refugee camps in Lebanon, in Gaza, the West Bank, so Palestinians and Palestinian refugees in the Middle East. But we hope we can expand. My work is sometimes posted on Mondo Weiss, sometimes in Counterpunch, or ZNet, or Palestine Chronicle, and I'm currently working on a book. So I hope something comes of that.
You can bet we'll be talking about it when it's ready. Thank you so much, Dr. Jennifer Lowenstein, the Middle East Studies program at Madison University of Wisconsin, and for your good work, your humanitarian work, as well as that thoughtful tour regarding events breaking along the crown of Africa in Egypt and Libya.
It's going to be interesting. The next few years are going to be very interesting years.
Well, thank you, Jennifer. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York. More after this.
We're moving right out of Babylon, and we're going to our father's land. Yeah, how good and how pleasant it would be before God and man, yeah, to see the unification of all Africans. Grew
Bob Marley, Africa Unite, apropos of Egypt and Libya, two nations which once discussed the possibility of an international union, much separate from the support that Libyan Arab Jamahiriya has historically given to the African Union. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and there's still more developing in the Crown of Africa, in particular in Libya. And that has caused a recent alarm by the humanitarian organization Amnesty International, which just issued a bulletin saying that militia rule is strangling human rights in Libya and threatening the progress of the presumed revolution there. We're very honored to be joined by Sanjeev Berry, the advocacy director on the Middle East. And what are your concerns? Welcome back, Sanjeev, by the way.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
What are your concerns about the militiatocracy in Libya?
Well, Amnesty International is very concerned because a patchwork of militias across the country is still running the show when it comes to detaining people without warrants, without any due process, when it comes to torture, and when it comes to acting with total impunity. And now is the time for the new Libyan government to start moving the country back in the direction of accountability and to end these dark days in which thousands of people are being held in these private detention centers across the country.
One of the most foremost questions in regard to that is the continuing racial antagonism and discriminatory rounding up without due process and detention and even murders of people of Afro-Libyan heritage or even those merely with dark skin. Is that still going on?
Yes, very much so. In fact, one of the most grotesque and extreme examples of that is that an entire city of some 30,000 Tawarga people, and the Tawargas are quote-unquote black Libyans, a specific tribal and ethnic group, the entire town was emptied by force by people from the nearby town of Misrata, who were among the various anti-Qaddafi forces. And people of Tawarga background are frequently arrested, are harassed, and in many cases have been detained and tortured even now, and have all been sort of collectively blamed in some ways of the allegations being that their community was allied with the old Libyan regime of Qaddafi.
It's something of an irony for a segment of an African nation to annex an African town.
You know, it's part of the sort of politics of revenge. I mean, the Misrata militias have accused the Tawarga community or people from the Tawarga community of attacking Misrata during the rebellion against Qaddafi, and now there's a collective punishment that's been meted out as a result. And it's just one of many examples in which Libya today is plagued by lawlessness and plagued by this problem of hundreds of armed militias in the aftermath of the overthrow of Qaddafi, who are exacting their own forms of justice without due process and frequently with heavy levels of torture.
Sanjeev, it's my understanding that the militias still work as a nonpareil kind of set of autonomous districts, that the Tripoli Belhajian militia is different from those in the east, in Cyrenaica and so on. And does this dissolution of a unified central government mean that human rights and due process are pretty much a flip of a coin?
There's definitely an extreme level of chaos today, and you even have situations where people in Libya have been detained and held and tortured by one militia, then finally released, only to be re-abducted, recaptured by another militia, and then had to experience the same set of horrors all over again. And this is part of the problem, and that's why Amnesty International is calling on the new government to start consolidating justice and to bring a lot of these private militias into a process of demobilization and to bring the detention centers into a formal centralized government control so people can start getting released.
Well, it was the international community, and by international community, I mean the Obama administration, through the proxy of NATO and France and Italy and other nations, that created this devolution into regional and tribal chaos in Libya. And given the military power, economic power, oil interest intervention in Libya, how can the international community help re-improve the situation they created? Or is it beyond that at this point?
It's definitely not beyond that. You know, the big one of the big challenges, among many challenges, is that the 42 years of prior to the rebellion, the multiple decades of Gaddafi's rule, were a period of time where civil society was prevented from developing, where people were heavily penalized for organizing or raising their voices. And so today in Libya, you have a huge problem, which is a significant lack of technical expertise when it comes to running a proper judicial system, setting up proper courts so that these detainees can be released, they can have their day in court, they can confront their accusers, all of those things. So the international community can help in two significant ways. One is the international community can provide the funding and resources for the technical expertise to stand up a functioning system of justice. And then two, the international community can provide the pressure and the public calls to stand down the militias and to put pressure so that a central government has the support it needs to transition the country out of this kind of lawless era.
There is not only a lack of due process for ordinary citizens, but what about the state of the members who are in the custody of different militias of the Gaddafi family, and even people who once served in the Jamahiriya?
Absolutely. You know, everybody deserves their day in court, and that's because there are so many examples where people who are innocent or simply being, you know, associated by virtue of ethnicity or skin color with past crimes of the Libyan government are being held. That's why there is a need for a uniform system of due process so that no matter what one is being accused of, and thousands of people have been accused and abducted for allegedly being involved in the prior Gaddafi government, no matter what one is accused of, that there is an opportunity to see what those accusations are and to see what evidence there is to back it up. I mean, right now, people are literally being picked up off the street. They are being pulled out of their workplaces. In some cases, people have been stopped at the airport in Tripoli and then abducted at that point. It's that kind of chaos and vigilante lawlessness that is part of the problem right now.
Do you think the alleged election of Mr. Jibril, Mahmoud Jibril, makes the situation more progressive or less stable?
Well, Amnesty International is certainly urging the new government, including Mr. Jibril, to help move forward in a process of transition so that these militias can be demobilized, so that there are steps to prevent human rights violators from entering the new government, especially the new military. We don't want these militias simply integrated into a new national military, and to build up the capacity so that Libya can start addressing both the human rights violations that are happening now, as well as the history of decades of human rights violations. So, you know, we as a global organization and as members of a global community have to keep the spotlight shining on these human rights violations so that that transition can happen.
Sanjeev Berry is the Advocacy Director on Middle East Affairs for Amnesty International, and I thank you so much for joining us today. And Sanjeev, for people who care to know more about trying to save lives, rights, and due process in Libya with this project that you're involved in, how can people learn more?
The easiest way is to go to our U.S. website, which is amnestyusa.org.
there would be a Middle East section there? Or?
Absolutely. There's a Middle East section, and if you click on our news and report sections, you can get access to our information on Libya.
Well, thank you for the good work you do, and all the best health, safety, and success for your colleagues in the field who are keeping track of these things, a very important piece of work.
Thank you, and thanks for having me.
All right, this is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York. We'll be back with more on AIDS. Africa, Akon, 5 O'Clock Shadow, Pacifica Radio Network, Robert Knight, New York. And finally today, we consider the plight of people suffering from HIV and or AIDS. Since the beginning of this month, the Obama administration and officials of 10 other nations have been negotiating a so-called Trans-Pacific Free Trade Agreement, whose goal is to further liberalize, as they call it, the economics of the Asian-Pacific region. But these negotiations are being held in secret in San Diego, California, and negotiators have already agreed that all of the interim documents will be kept under lock and seal, except for possibly the final text, which will not itself be disclosed until 4 years after the agreement takes effect. One of the propositions defends the expansion of drug patent monopolies and could thereby jeopardize the production of so-called generic drugs, which are, as a rule, produced more cheaply than the high-cost patents or copyrighted company-named medicines, such as the so-called HIV or AIDS cocktails. And recently, a group of protesters gathered in front of the New York headquarters of the Pfizer Corporation. The pharmaceutical company has paid the lobbying firm Aiken, Gump, Strauss, Hauer, and Feld nearly $100,000 to lobby Congress, the trade representative, commerce, and other agencies on issues involving so-called intellectual property protections in the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. 5 o'clock Shadow producer Thiago Barroso was there at that protest and reports thusly for 5 o'clock Shadow.
They don't care who ends up dead. What we need are generic meds. Pfizer and Obama love the TPP. K-I-L-L-I-N-G. They don't care who ends up dead. What we need are generic meds. Pfizer and Obama love the TPP. K-I-L-L-I-N-G. They don't care who ends up dead. What we need are generic meds.
Hi, Robert. We are here on 42nd Street between 2nd and 3rd Avenue in front of the headquarters of Pfizer, the pharmaceutical company, where there is a group gathering and protesting for affordable AIDS drugs.
Love the TPP. K-I-L-L-I-N-G.
My name is Michael Tequili. I'm an AIDS activist internationally, and the reason I'm here is to protest against Pfizer. Pfizer is one of the many pharmaceuticals that has a stake in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is one of the largest free trade agreements ever negotiated by the United States. And the reason why this is so important for AIDS activists is because the Trans-Pacific Partnership has a section of intellectual property rights that's just seriously horrible for generic drugs, production of generic drugs. So basically, Pfizer is lobbying in favor of this to the government. And if they get their way, countries like Vietnam and Malaysia, which are a part of this free trade agreement, will not be allowed to create generic drugs. This is horrid because generic drugs are what's really sustaining the majority of people that are HIV positive around the world. When it comes to the AIDS movement, currently two-thirds of the world's population still doesn't have access to drugs. And so, you know, when it comes to generic production, we need to secure that around the world. And the Trans-Pacific Partnership is seriously going to hinder the production of generic drugs. And so what we're saying here right now is that if our government is serious about ending the AIDS crisis, which they've said they are, then they won't sign on to this free trade agreement, which will harm the production of generic drugs.
And when is this agreement supposed to be signed?
So currently, we're doing this action in solidarity with the there's currently a negotiation happening in California, and so we're doing this in solidarity with activists there. But there's several big pharma companies, Pfizer, there's a slew of others who are all in favor of it, and our government is unfortunately siding with corporate greed, and it's time that we sort of highlight the need to respect the lives of human beings. You know, if we go along with this free trade agreement, the reality is that many people are going to die. It's a death sentence for people living with HIV and AIDS around the world. They don't even have access to medication in certain countries. Two-thirds of the world's HIV population still need these generic drugs to survive. And the last thing we need is for Big Pfizer and other countries and other pharmaceutical companies to mess up generic production in developing countries. And so we're here to tell them no. We're here to tell them to put lies before profits. And that's why we're protesting out here today.
My name is Adam Weissman, A-D-A-M-W-E-I-S-S-M-A-N. I'm with Trade Justice New York Metro. And I'm here today as Barack Obama. Very happy that the Trans-Pacific Partnership remains a secret negotiation, hoping that people don't hear too much from these protesters, because in 2008, I ran on a promise that I would fix NAFTA, that I would improve our nation's broken trade policy, and I just don't want people to know that I've now included the NAFTA countries in a new trade agreement that's described as NAFTA on steroids, that takes everything bad about NAFTA for the 99% and it makes it worse. But because at the end of the day, the 1%, the people financing my campaign, love the TPP. They love expanded corporate patent rights. They love intellectual property rules that undermine environmental laws. They love the globalization of industrial factory farms and the destruction of local family farm economies. And so I don't want people to know about this TPP, because if they know about it, people will realize that I completely lied to them and broke all my campaign promises to fix our nation's trade policy and have totally sold out to the corporate interests who are the real constituency I represent. I just want people to think about hope and change. I don't want them to hear about TPP. That's why we've made sure that 600 corporations have the inside track on the negotiation. That's why we've made sure that the negotiating text won't be released until 4 years after the negotiations are done. People shouldn't know that I'm pushing for rules in this trade agreement that are even worse for Peru in terms of access to generic drugs than Bush's Peru free trade agreement. People shouldn't know that I'm much worse on these trade issues and worse on access to generic drugs than George Bush, because I need liberals to vote for me. I need people to be fooled. I need people to keep saying hope and change. So we need to keep TPP a secret. So I don't want to see protests like this. It's outrageous. People shouldn't know.
I have another person here. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
Why are you here today?
Well, I have a big problem personally with Pfizer, how they, what they do with their generic drugs. You know, I have to go to Canada to smuggle drugs in, because I can buy their drugs in Canada cheaper than I can buy them here. And they're manufactured here because of the deal our government signed, number one, with the Medicare prescription drug. They were not allowed to negotiate the prices. That was the giveaway to Big Pharma for them to pass it. And it's insane that Medicare is the biggest purchaser of drugs in the world, and they pay the highest prices because of the deal that was cut. So these people are criminals. I mean, this guy's talking about Obama, but what we had and what they're saying he did do to get his health care bill passed. But you know something? What's coming is even worse.
Why is that even worse?
Because he only cares about, you know, Obama has done some socially good things, but a guy like Romney, he is the one. He is less than the one. He's the 1%. And let me tell you, and he doesn't hide it. You know what? They want to give tax cuts to the rich. That's the, you know, and to corporations. That's the main thing. They're doing fine. They lay people off. They have less people doing more work for less pay, and they're making big profits. So, you know, this recovery that we're going to have, there is going to be no recovery. We're going to be Japan. We're going to be in a recession and deflation for the next 15, 20 years.
So why is that cheaper to buy drugs in Canada than here?
Because the U.S. Pfizer's and other companies manufacture drugs that they sell to Canada. They sell it to Canada cheaper than they sell it to the U.S. government.
There are several people here standing in front of the headquarters of Pfizer on 42nd Street between 2nd and 3rd Avenues, and they are protesting for affordable AIDS drugs and other issues as well. I get back to you. This is Thiago Barroso for 5 o'clock shadow.
Pfizer and Obama love the TPP. K-I-L-L-I-N-G. They don't care who ends up dead. What we need are generic meds. Pfizer and Obama love the TPP. K-I-L-L-I-N-G. They don't care who ends up dead. What we need are generic meds.
Thiago Barroso reporting on the scene for 5 o'clock shadow in stereo. And that concludes today's edition of the program that was produced with Thiago Barroso and engineered by Michael G. Haskins. We welcome your contributions, suggestions, tips, leaks, and questions with an email to theshadow@wbai.org. And for 5 o'clock shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.